Matthew, the 22nd chapter, the 34th through the 40th verses. The problem is there are a lot of people who are interested in finding faith, who want to grow, who want to go from where they are to where they ought to go, but who feel either because you and I have told them, or they generally assume in their own minds, that they must pass a heresy test to be acceptable to the church. And their deep sense of integrity keeps them as reserved disciples, if disciples at all, simply because there are things that you and I allegedly believe that they're not sure they can buy, at least not hook, line, and sinker, at least not totally. As Sir Richard Acland in his work, We Teach Them Wrong, says, because they cannot believe in physical resurrection or the virgin birth or miracles or etc., they stay outside the church even when they find the Spirit of Christ almost irresistibly magnetic. The question I want to raise in this number one sermon in this series is, do you have to believe everything, in order to be a good Christian? All my life I have believed yes, until 2 weeks ago, and now I say no. I want to share it with you. All my life I have believed that a good Christian did in fact believe certain things, and that you could be Christian, you could be religious, but not good Christian unless you could adhere to the party line. Now, this is not to imply that I do not believe since 2 weeks ago. It's to say that there are some things that, I believe, in fact, I do believe almost everything that good guys are supposed to believe. Almost everything. But that's not what I'm talking about. I am saying that there are people who genuinely want to find a meaningful walk with the living God, who cannot buy dogma per se precisely the way we prescribe it. And it isn't necessary. This is part of the problem. It isn't necessary. For in order to go, I do not have to truthfully and fully believe everything about jets, our boats, our cars, our television, our girls, or anything. It simply is not part of God's structuring of this world. There is a point where I decide what I want to go with, and I don't have to believe everything there is to believe about a television set. I don't have to be able to quote chapter and verse. I know very little about cars. It hurts my male ego to say that. I know how to crank it up and which way to point it. And like all ministers, I drive like a maniac, and it gets me there. But I don't understand much there is to know about that car. And yet, in all the crass illogics born of insecure, frightened people, we continue to insist, quite contrary to our Lord, that in order to be a good Christian, you have to live contrary to all logic and different from anything else. Dogma, that is, a systemic concept of beliefs, can be, one, an ego trip. Two, they can be security blankets. Even before, in this point of this increment of my own Christian growth, very recently, even before then, whenever I heard somebody get up and wave their Bible under my nose or under somebody else's nose and say, if you don't believe everything in it, you have no right to believe any of it, in my amateurish psychologizing, they have always impressed me as being frightened and insecure people. It can be a security blanket. Or thirdly, it can just be a roadblock rather than a bridge. For I think The part of the problem is that we have so embellished God's great message that we're very much like the legend of Moses' flute. When he played for Jethro's, when he played for Jethro's sheep as he watched them as a shepherd boy prior to his great mission in the world, this flute was kept, so legend tells us. But as faith began to grow, it was considered too plain, too common, because now it entered into a real adoration and adulation. And so they embellished it with gold and with jewels. And in fact, it did become more beautiful, but it no longer could be played as a beautiful instrument. And so we, in our ego problems, in our insecurity, which is really clinical, even though we assume it's theological, we insist and demand that people adhere to a certain dogma, to certain theological understandings, when all the time that's so inconsistent with reality that we ought to be ashamed of ourselves, as I have now become of me, for this kind of blatant inconsistency. For people are saying, I would like to hear a clear, beautiful message. I want to know what can help me rather than what you think you ought to believe, or even what you hold to be sacred in belief. Margaret Chaplin Anderson put it this way in a wail from a distressed soul. Oh, preacher, holy man, hear my heart weeping. I long to stand and shout my protest when you preach. Where is your power and where is your message? And where is this gospel of mercy and love? Your words are nothingness, nothingness, nothingness. We who have come to listen are betrayed. Servant of God, I am bitter and desolate. What do I care for perfection of phrase? Cursed be your humor, your poise, your diction. See how my soul turns to ashes within me. You who have vowed to declare your Redeemer, give me the words that would save. That's what she's saying. Forget the embellishment. Nobody cares about the carrot. Nobody cares about the gold or the glitter. I want to hear something that will help my soul within me that is turning to ashes. And I don't want to incur some heresy-hunting vigilante in the church who's going to tell me what I've got to believe when I don't even know who I am, much less what I believe. I am coming to believe passionately. That means you're going to hear more about it. I'm coming to believe passionately that Christianity is a way of life, not a theological system with which one must be in intellectual agreement. I see, as a Christian in my own pilgrimage, more and more that Christ admits into discipleship anyone who sincerely wants to follow him and are willing to learn as they grow in that experience. Now, did you hear that? Did you hear that? That's so important. I am beginning to see. I've always believed it, but I'm saying in this whole sermon that belief doesn't always mean anything. I am now beginning to see, really see, that Christ admits into discipleship real conversion experience those of us who are willing to follow and learn as we go along. It's just as Paul said, I know in whom I have believed. He didn't say, I know what I believe. Now, we all know he believed something. But he said, I know in whom I have believed. Or as Herbert Butterfield, a Cambridge historian, put it, stand fast with Christ, and as for the rest, remain uncommitted. And that's a good principle. Of course, only secure people can handle that. But stand fast with Christ, and for the rest remain uncommitted. So the problem is this. We, now that means you and I, tell people that if they are to be a good Christian, they must believe certain specified things And we do the specification or the specifying, and they stay outside. That's the problem. Now, the record is really very different from that. And now that I have accepted that, I don't know how I ever missed it, except that I have such a thick skull. It's very difficult for me to grasp reality. Most opinionated, frightened people are like that, and I certainly am one of them. The record is totally contrary to that type situation. For if Christ can, and he does, hold in utter loyalty the hearts of St. Francis and John Knox, of Calvin and St. Teresa, of General Booth and Pope John, of Billy Graham and Albert Schweitzer, who hold totally irreconcilable views of him, then belief, or how we believe, or the uniformity of belief, is virtually unimportant. Furthermore, the record shows that no matter how important beliefs are and how sacred they may be to me, as most of them most certainly are, the record shows that Jesus Christ never once said, you've got to believe a certain thing. He always said, follow me. I don't know how I missed it. I've always believed that he was most important, but I've always believed that good Christians believe certain things, as do so many of us who hesitate in our discipleship because we're too honest to be phony. And we ought not to do that, because the record shows you can be as real and authentic. In fact, it is just as we are without one plea, whereby we find this great experience. Jesus never one time in his ministry ever mentioned the virgin birth. I'm not putting that down. I believe it. I have intellectual problems with it. I have times emotionally where I say, that sounds real funny to me. That's going to offend some of you, and that's good. We need offending. I'm just sorry it's a rainy day and there are not more here to offend. But I think we need to come to grips with the fact that you can know and believe all there is to know about Jesus Christ and never be his follower at all. And he never in his entire recorded ministry ever mentioned, let alone advocate belief in, the virgin birth. Now, if that says nothing else, it says this, that maybe, while it is important, there are other things that really count more. For when he spoke to Peter and to Levi and to Saul of Tarsus and the thief on the cross and to Andrew, he simply said, follow me, follow me. When Jesus spoke to Martha, he said, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, not about me, but in me. You see, part of the problem, and the record bears this out, is this. Some of us who believe everything don't belong. And some people who don't believe anything are really beginning to belong. Now, of course, there's a mixture of that that's true. You can believe and belong. If you believe something, I don't want you to quit the church. I'm not advocating that. I've shared this with you before, but the Allport studies on the nature of racial prejudice in America show conclusively that churches that tend to be most biblical are also the hotbeds of racial prejudice in America. Now, that means one of two things. The closer you get to God, the meaner you are, or that he who says, Lord, Lord, is not always going to enter the kingdom of God. You can believe everything in this whole world about your TV set and still never use it. In fact, some of the biggest cop-outs I know in the church are those of us who say, I know I should, and I believe this, and I believe I ought to start tithing, and I believe I ought to reshape my priorities, and I believe in God, and we believe until we have entered into a psychodynamic release mechanism where we've lost all of our compulsion to do it. So you see, there are those of us who believe everything who do not belong. And they are those on the far increment who believe nothing and yet are beginning to belong. John Wesley put it this way, let but a pert, insufficient animal, now John Wesley said this, I didn't, let but a pert, insufficient animal who has neither sense nor grace bawl out something about Jesus and his blood, and then let somebody else say, my, what a fine gospel sermon. Now what is he saying there? He's saying you can use all the right words. Believe in Jesus and his blood, which I do, but still not be anywhere in proclaiming the good news. You may have only a gold-encrusted heart that looks good and helps your ego as you lug it around, but it does not convey the great redeeming message of mercy and love. The record lends absolutely no support whatsoever to the assumption that you've got to believe the right things in order to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. Okay, now that's the problem. That's the record. What's the solution? Jesus Christ put his finger right on the solution, and I think that's a good source, by the way. This lawyer came up to him one day, having heard that he had really put the Democrats out of business, and he says, he can't put a Republican out of business. I'll really lay it on him. So he came up and he said, good master, I learned a long time ago when somebody comes up and says, Reverend, you're in for it. He said, good master, what is the greatest? Do you hear that word? Listen to me now. It's raining hard. We're going to be here all day, so you might as well just concentrate, because I'm going to keep on until I feel like it's been said. He said, Master, what is the greatest of all the commands? Isn't that what we're talking about? And Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And the second is similar to it, love your neighbor as yourself. But we don't even need it. We're not even talking about the second. We don't need to go down any ladder of increments, because what we're talking about this morning is what is the greatest, the super top dog that God expects of us, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your heart, your soul, and your mind. Let's look at that. First of all, he uses the word heart. Now, to the Greeks, the heart represented the very seat of our emotions. To this very day, when someone says, love me with all your heart, they don't mean by that, believe all there is to believe about me. They mean by that, give me a deep commitment that will be a growing process. Let me give you the actual Greek words he uses. The two words are agapes kardia. Those are the words Christ used. Agapes kardia. And what that literally means is to fasten yourself to someone from the very seat of your emotion, regardless of what they will do for you. A lot of people say, I would love God if he'd give me the right feeling. We're feelers, we are. We're not looking for salvation. We're looking for a feeling. Kardia, agapes kardia means to give my deep heart commitment to a person if they don't give me anything. But you see, that's the way a man falls in love. A man looks at a woman, and by the way, this works the other way around too. But a man looks at a woman and he says, I like that. That looks super good to me. And you say, well, what do you believe about her? He says, I don't believe anything about her, but I sure am attracted. And then in agapes kardia, he gives her the very foundation of his emotion. And as they continue to develop their relationship, he slowly begins to be able to write a creed. That's the way it works. Robert Browning did not love Elizabeth Barrett. He married her because she was rich. Now, I remember last Sunday I preached on the fact that you've got to start where you are. He married her because she was rich. But he fell in love with her, and as their relationship began to unfold, he finally said, in words of his pen, "How do I love you? Let me count the ways." You see, a love affair begins like that, where we just simply sense that in all my goodness, in all my struggle and self-made mentality, I need to find someone I want to spend the rest of my life with, who is God, who can really help me. This is what Jesus was saying, agape cardia, give God the very seat of your emotions. Let him be the ultimate love commitment in your life. And then secondly, he says, soul. The actual Greek, again, that he used was, well, of course, he spoke in Aramaic, but it was the actual Greek it was translated into was this, en hole te suke. I read that for two reasons, because I love to show off like that. But secondly, because it's very poorly translated. Now, that always irritates the fundamentalists to have that said. And if it didn't irritate you, if you'll raise your hand, I'll say it again. It is a poor translation. En hole te suke in the Greek literally means what we've always said it to mean. To actually care for someone so much, my life shows it. It's literally translated with all my life. We use the phrase like this. Someone says to us, love me with all your soul. And what they mean by that is, let it show. Let it make a difference in your life. Let it affect your way of living. In other words, if we're really entering into meaningful faith, I mean, we show our soul every day. People know we have what kind of soul we have by what they see in our lives. If we are gossiping church types, that shows them the smallness of our soul. If we are racially hatred, bigoted, or if we are love and kindness and understanding and compassion, our lives demonstrate our soul. Show me your soul. I show you my soul by the way I live. And that's what Jesus is talking about. In fact, in Revelation 12:11, that same word, suke, is translated just like this. Our brothers won the victory by their willingness to give up their lives. So you see, Jesus is saying, if you really want to believe, it isn't a matter of what you give intellectual assent to, but it's a matter of giving God the very depth of your heart, your first initial commitment to begin to learn a relationship, and then secondly, let that relationship become demonstrably evident. J.H. Oldham in Life is Commitment puts it this way. I am confident, this is a good statement, now listen carefully. I am confident that if a single ray of light reaches a man from Christ, penetrates into his being, and influences his way of living, he is further along the road toward true belief in him than if he gave his unreflecting assent to a multitude of orthodox propositions which have no perceptible effect upon his conduct. Leslie Weatherhead put it this way. You can assent, that is, you can say you believe, because you're afraid, or you want to please, or you haven't the energy or skill to think a thing out. But belief, when it really happens, is when something takes possession of you, and it shows. That's what soul means, en hole en hos suke, soul. To love him with all my soul is to demonstrate operative belief that something is working in my life that's making me more loving and more Christ-like and kinder, more sympathetic and all those things that Christians ought to be. Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, cardia, with all your soul, psuche, and thirdly, with all your mind. We don't believe the mind really enters into faith. A lot of us don't. That it is an emotional reaction, that it is often dishonesty, that if you have a good mind, you can't be a Christian. And yet we never stop to evaluate that some of the greatest philosophers, some of the greatest thinkers of all time have been very deep, yes, very pietistic Christians. You want to know why? Because the word used here to translate mind is the word dianoia. It comes actually from two Greek words, dias, nous. Dia means God, deity, dia. Nous, if you like to collect trivia, is the word from which we get our English word noodle, means intellect. Isn't that clever? Dia nua means to have God intelligence. In other words, to have a mind that is so honest. Follow this now. This really excites me. I can see how excited you are. It means to have a mind that's so honest it will not settle for hand-me-down gods. Mother's God. Aunt Bessie Lou's God. It takes into account the stark reality that God is not fragile, that truth is not precarious. It can be bisected, dissected, attacked, anything, because you cannot break it. You cannot break it. And God is patient. He wants us to take our intelligence and do exactly what Jesus said in the word dianoia. Let your mind seek out ultimate truth. Be willing to hang in there. Be willing to be honest. Don't settle for a hand-me-down God or for the cop-out that says, I cannot be a disciple because I don't believe certain things. To truly endeavor to understand that which is so much greater than you and me, we must inevitably face some degree of reverent agnosticism. Yes. A time in which we must say, I simply do not know. Browning said, God's gift was that man should conceive of truth and yearn to gain it, catching at mistakes as midway help till he reaches fact indeed. Weatherhead advocates in a book I read recently entitled The Christian Agnostic that every growing Christian who wants to gain God intelligence, dianoia, to come to that place where they really in their minds begin to fathom the greatness of God, he said there needs to be a category that he has come to label awaiting further light. I like that. Because there are things in the Christian faith that sometimes I really believe and other times I feel very self-conscious about, and I stand around and I think, that really sounds fishy to me. That really sounds funny. And Weatherhead says, take those and put them up in a pigeonhole where they won't get lost under a label that says, awaiting further light, knowing that if it's true, God, in my intelligence, if I'm participating in this dianoia, God will give me new light on it, and if it isn't, it'll get lost. And it isn't that important anyway, unless it is true. You see, God intelligence demands this kind of honesty. Tennyson said, there lives more faith in honest doubt, believe me, than in half the creeds. And again, it's like driving a car or using your television or flying in a plane. You don't have to understand much. All you have to know about a television is how to turn it on. All you have to know about a car is a little more, but nothing compared with the intricacies of the engine and the electrical system. And jet planes, how many of us fly without knowing anything about jet planes? So it is with God intelligence. To be honest with our minds, I believe in a God who is real, whose faith is not fragile, whose truth is not precarious. And what we need more than anything else in the world is a personal encounter with the living God through Jesus Christ. And I believe that's the only way it comes, because that's been my experience and hundreds I've worked with. But when we have taken the step of following Him, to be able to